Welcome back to a special RN Christmas Breakfast with Noel Debien and me, Rachel Kahn.
Herod called together the wise men and said, "Search carefully for the child. When you find him, tell me, so that I too may worship him." But having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, the wise men left for their own country by a different road. After they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up, take the child and his mother, and flee to Egypt," he said. "Stay there until I tell you, because Herod intends to search for the child and kill him." So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and left at night for Egypt. Herod flew into a rage when he learned he had been tricked by the wise men. So he ordered the execution of all male children, 2 years old and younger, in Bethlehem and all its neighboring regions. What was declared by the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and great mourning. Rachel was crying for her children. She refused to be comforted because they no longer existed. After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt. "Get up," he said. "Take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, because those who were trying to kill the child are dead." But when Joseph heard that Herod's son was ruling over Judea, he was afraid. So he left for the region of Galilee and settled in a town called Nazareth in order to fulfill what was said by the prophets. "He will be called a Nazarene."
Well, there's a famous voice, Rachel. I wonder if anybody picked it.
I did. The good Hamish MacDonald.
It was. Well, that gospel account that he's reading there, as well as lots of Christmas carols, give a really strong sense of place. And it's a Middle East which was also characterised by conflict. And, I mean, you know, Judea was part of the Roman Empire, and you know about Herod, the local king, who was basically the Gaddafi of his time. He was
indeed
a terrorist.
Indeed. Yeah. He was described as a madman who murdered his own family. And even a great many rabbis.
But there's even more attractive information of him recorded, that he was prepared to commit any crime in order to gratify his unbounded ambition.
Well, that sounds pretty familiar. 2,000 years on, people are still fleeing terror and tyranny and fear for their lives. Last month, I was at the G20 Interfaith Conference in Turkey. We were there to talk about religious freedom and sustainability, but inevitably, the discussions would turn to the refugee crisis. I had a really interesting chat with the director of charities of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. Sharon Eubank had just returned from northern Iraq.
You know, Iraq and the northern part of Iraq, where the Kurdish regional government is, they are hosting 48 or 52 camps, I can't remember which. And they're all different kinds of people. They are Syrians who have fled the war, Christians and minorities, Yazidis, who have been driven out of cities by ISIS, and there are people who have fled the violence down in the south. And so they all have different religious convictions, they have different reasons for being there, and they have different historical backgrounds. It's a very, very complex situation in Iraq.
What were you doing there exactly?
LDS Charities is partnering with a group from the UK called AMAR to put educational facilities and help primary health care clinics in camps. So in conjunction with the Ministry of Health, making sure that the camps have access to primary education and primary health care. So I was looking at some of those and then figuring out what are still the gaps and what do we need to do next.
So these are people who have been in these camps and in these tents for well up to 2 years?
You know, it was really interesting. I went to a camp called Kaurgask, and the last time I had been to that particular camp, it was 7 days old. So that mayor got a phone call from the governor that said, I'm sending you 7,000 refugees. It's at 4 o'clock in the morning. He said, they'll be there at 10, so you get ready. So he got up out of bed. He called his police chief. They woke up all the restaurant owners and said, start making food. And they plotted out into the desert a place where people could come and live. So when I got there 7 days into it, he said, we don't have any kitchen utensils. People can't cook. You know, we can't have the restaurants continue to feed everybody. So we provided thousands and thousands of sets of family kitchen sets. Well, now, 3 years into it, I went back to that camp. It's a very established camp. It's very old. It's very dirty because it was hastily set up and the sewage hasn't been set up in the right way. People were very excited when they first came because they'd been through a terrible experience and now they were getting someplace safe. And to see the deadness in their eyes, the despair of their kids haven't been in school for 3 years, and what are they going to do, and are they ever going to go home? It was really a contrast from when they first came and now 3 years into it.
Are they, in fact, wanting to go home, or are they fearful? Or, you know, has their experience at the hands of their neighbors, perhaps, really put them in a no man's land, really?
It depends on what happened to them and what religious minority they belong to. Some of them, Syrians, they are aching to go home. They don't remember Aleppo anyway except the way it's always been. Even though the pictures that you see now, they don't think of it that way. They just want to go home to where they were from. But Yazidis and Christian minorities who really suffered at the hands of their neighbors. One of the people that I met, it was their family dentist who abused the girls and held them hostage and tortured them. And can you imagine going back into that kind of society? So they won't go back. They don't want to. And they will look for different settlements. And I heard somebody in the conference say, this migration of populations, it's permanent. It's never going to go back to the way it was. So we have to adjust to a new kind of reality.
Working in the field of humanitarian care, many people think of this as just providing the goods, the structures, the facilities, the infrastructure. But is that really enough? What is it that actually will bring the light back in those people's eyes?
Of course, when there's a terrible emergency, the first thing that you're worried about is how to feed and clothe people, how to get them secure, how to, you know, get them out of the rain. But very early on, it becomes necessary. They've been through terrible trauma. One of the biggest gaps is what they call psychosocial counseling. But it's more than psychiatry. It's how do they heal from the traumatic experiences that they've been through. The Yazidi population, not well known. I think before this crisis, hardly anyone understood. But they have a very sacred place in Kurdistan called Lalish, which is the site of their temple. And I happened to be there, and there were two women outside the gate. They had come from a long way away. They were elderly women. They were wearing the traditional white clothing. And I just greeted them, and they just started to cry. And they, you know, I don't speak their language, but they were just saying about their family members that had been taken by Daesh. They were talking about that. And they had come to Lalish, the site of their temple, for spiritual sustenance. They wanted to be there in a place where they could heal from this terrible thing. And I think one of the huge gaps in humanitarian aid is because we're either so busy worrying about those other things, or there isn't funding, or we're not concentrating on what faith-based organizations can actually offer, we forget that spiritual healing is the crux of everything else. They will never be able to progress in the rest of their life without that kind of healing.
You come from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So how do you relate to a Yazidi? How do you give them that kind of spiritual sustenance?
When I met with the Yazidi leaders, I explained my own faith tradition. We were refugees ourselves. We were persecuted for our faith inside the United States in the middle 1800s, 1830s. We were driven out of what was then the United States and had to settle in the western part where nobody wanted. It was a desert, and of course it grew up, and Salt Lake City is a place. There was no government funding. There were no NGOs. We had to solve all of those issues that came up as they happened. That's our faith tradition. I'm not saying that our faith would relate to Yazidis, but our experience and using faith to solve those kinds of problems can. And I think that's the way that we can relate with one another.
You said that the object of aid is to build character. What did you mean?
It's about rescuing what is unique and the finest that's down deep inside each person and letting that come up and grow and flower so that they can be the kinds of people that they are meant to be. That requires a space for their own faith, the faith that they have chosen, and also tolerance so that that seed can actually grow and flourish. If those conditions are present, then those people who have the seed of their character flowering and growing in them, they'll take themselves out of their condition. They'll need help, they'll need aid and protection, but they have the ability inside them to do that. I am as worried about your rights to flower and flourish as I am about my own. And then under those conditions, everything else can be worked on.
This is very interesting because you're putting religious interfaith relationships at the core in humanitarian aid, and particularly faith-based aid, which very often people see as just a particular religion, possibly with proselytizing aims. And you're saying it's tolerance and acceptance and interfaith.
I had an interesting experience. I was at the United Nations speaking, and there was a big group of people. And after I'd finished, I asked for questions. And I had talked about LDS charities. And a woman in the back raised her hand, and she said, "Look, let's just call a spade a spade." She said, "You are in this not to give aid and relief, but you're in this for converts, for the LDS faith." And there was scattered applause. And I realized at that time that that misconception of what faith-based organizations do, that it's about conversion and about persuading people and, you know, rice Christians, all of that stuff, that is such a prevalent misconception. And truthfully, some faith-based organizations have added to that misperception. But to have any kind of credibility, we must be able to have that character, that tolerance to say, the scriptures say, charity seeketh not its own. No question the LDS faith is a teaching faith, but this is not that part of the faith. This cannot be that part of the faith, so that we can create a neutral space where people can heal. We are brothers and sisters. We're all children of the same God, and we can treat each other that way no matter what else we believe.
Sudden departure. My neighbor too, جاري أيضا, without notes, رحل دون إشارة, has departed. رحل دون عودة, departed without return. رحل دون مكان, departed without a place to go to, just like those who departed before. ككل الذين رحلوا, never knowing when or where, دون أن يعلموا متى أو أين. I wrote departed because in Iraq, a lot of people departed Iraq to many places on the earth. So departed, it's really like the death. So it's same. When my neighbor died, it's same, like anyone departed to any place. That's what I feel it. Maybe now I'm here in Australia. Maybe I can talk with my family in Iraq. But it's just talking.
Jamal al-Halak, the Iraqi poet there. He's now living in Sydney.
Well, what Jamal said there about separation from family really struck me. Talking on the phone or Skyping isn't like being together, and that's got to be a really common experience for many Australians today. The stats say 1 in 3 of us were born overseas or has at least one parent born overseas, which makes for 6.6 million of us in this immigration nation who probably can't share this holiday season with our extended family.
It is a bit sobering, but families can be separated for all sorts of reasons. And there's a piece by Arundhati Roy in her book, a prize-winning novel, The God of Small Things. She's trying to capture the awe, the wonder of a new father admiring the new baby, and also the pain of separation that's impending. You know, that's a pain, I think, Rachel, that many of us, parents or not, have really felt one time or another.
Those last few tortured nights before he left her, Chaco would slip out of bed with a torch and look at his sleeping child to learn her, imprint her on his memory, to ensure that when he thought of her, the child that he invoked would be accurate. He memorized the brown down on her soft skull, the shape of her puckered, constantly moving mouth, the spaces between her toes, the suggestion of a mole. The baby clutched his index finger. Her belly button protruded from her satiated satin stomach like a domed monument on a hill. Chaco laid his ear against it and listened with wonder at the rumblings from within. Messages being sent from here to there. New organs getting used to each other. A new government setting up its systems. Organizing the division of labor. Deciding who would do what. She smelled of milk and urine. Chaco marveled at how someone so small and undefined, so vague in her resemblances, could so completely command the attention, the love, the sanity of a grown man. When he left, he felt that something had been torn out of him, something big.
After that young father in Arundhati Roy's novel, The God of Small Things, that was Dean Martin, and that was his version of Silent Night. And Rachel, I think that qualifies as an Italian father singing a lullaby to his child.
Perhaps after a little bit too much champagne. You're with RN this Christmas morning with me, Rachel Kahn, and Noel Debian. And in Words, Music, and Interviews, we're looking at how the events of the first Christmas resonate in 2015. We hope it's a welcome change of pace for this unique day. And if you've only just joined us, you can find all the poems, readings, and conversations on the RN homepage. Just search On Breakfast.
What's the worth of a man without a homeland, without a flag, without an address? What is the worth of such a man?
No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark, You only run for the border when you see the whole city running as well. No one leaves home unless home chases you, fire under feet, hot blood in your belly. It's not something you ever thought of doing until the blade burnt threats into your neck. And even then, you carried the anthem under your breath, only tearing up your passport in an airport toilet, sobbing as each mouthful of paper made it clear you wouldn't be going back. But you have to understand that no one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. No one spends days and nights in the stomach of a truck feeding on newspaper unless the miles travelled mean something more than journey. No one crawls under fences. No one wants to be beaten, pitied. No one chooses refugee camps or strip searches where your body is left aching. Or prison, because prison is safer than a city on fire, and one prison guard in the night is better than a truckload of men who look like your father. No one could take it. No one could stomach it. No one's skin would be tough enough. The go-home blacks, refugees, dirty immigrants, asylum seekers, sucking our country dry, niggers with their hands out. They smell strange, savage, messed up their country, and now they want to mess ours up. How do the words, the dirty looks, roll off your backs? Maybe because the blow is softer than a limb torn off, or the insults are easier to swallow than rubble, than bone, than your child body in pieces. I want to go home, but home is the mouth of a shark. Home is the barrel of a gun, and no one would leave home unless home chased you to the shore, unless home told you to quicken your legs, leave your clothes behind, crawl through the desert, wade through the oceans, drown, save, be hunger, beg. Forget pride. Your survival is more important. No one leaves home until home is a sweaty voice in your ear saying, leave. Run away from me now. I don't know what I've become, but I know that anywhere is safer than here.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long way from home,
Odetta and Motherless Child, perhaps one of the saddest spirituals about slavery, with a lament for loss and displacement.
And before that, a gut-wrenching poem that really brings home to me the awful experience of becoming a refugee. The poet Warsan Shirey was a refugee from Somalia, but last year she became the first young poet laureate for London and was also Queensland Poet in Residence. You may recognise the poem. Actor Benedict Cumberbatch, star of The Imitation Game, Sherlock, he used it recently to appeal for support for Syrian refugees.
And speaking of celebrities, you all know RN's music show Andrew Ford, but perhaps you don't know that he's a composer. His latest work is a short mass, a Missa Brevis, called the Refugee Mass. Jeff Wood of RN's Rhythm Divine spoke to Andrew about the commission, his inspiration, and how the African spiritual Motherless Child became an important musical theme.
Well, Jeff also got an exclusive on this recording of the Mass, didn't he, before it premiered at St. John's Cathedral earlier this month?
going around Australia over the last few years, particularly in major cities, and you walk past a cathedral, and there on the wall is a great big banner saying, refugees are welcome here. And this is very much, you know, flying in the face of popular sentiment and certainly political sentiment. And I thought maybe the thing to do was to somehow use something in my piece, in my mass setting, that reflected this. And so I used the tune of the spiritual, Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child, in mine. And everywhere in the mass there is some reference to it. Occasionally, you never actually hear the whole tune, but there are fragments of it and sometimes something like the whole tune all the way through.
Like a motherless child, sometimes I feel like I'm almost done. Sometimes
the version that Odetta recorded, one of the versions that Odetta recorded, is used very powerfully by Pasolini in his film The Gospel According to St. Matthew, along with the music of Prokofiev and Mozart and the Missa Luba and Blind Willie Johnson. There's all sorts of music in that film. Music's used very well. But Odetta's version of Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child is very, very powerful. I imagine, I mean, we're not quite sure of the origins of most American spirituals, but I imagine that the first people who sang it were singing about slavery, about having been transported across the world. And so it seemed a very apt thing to use it in this context for people who are also either transported across the world or hoping to escape to another part of the world, people who find themselves adrift from their homes.
But a long way from home.
Now, Andy, for those not familiar with the Missa Brevis, what is it?
Well, it's a short mass. I mean, there are masses that are very, very long, where, for example, every bit of the Gloria has its own movement. Well, this isn't like that. This, if you sing the whole thing straight through, it takes about 13 minutes, I think. And so it's a kind of more useful mass than a big setting like the Bach B minor mass, which goes on for an hour and a half. So there's that. And also, traditionally, the Missa Brevis doesn't have the credo. The credo is dealt with in some other way in the liturgy. It was commissioned by four Australian cathedrals, two Anglican and two Catholic, St. John's and St. Stephen's in Brisbane, St. George's in Perth, and St. Patrick's in Melbourne, along with, I should say, Father Arthur Bridge, who has been a serial commissioner of Australian music through Ars Musica Australis.
Mr. Morton, can we remind about mobile phones, please?
Yes, please, guys. Can you turn your mobile phone off, please? Don't put it on silent. That's not good enough because the vibrations
are... This is Peter Catt. I'm the Dean of St. John's Cathedral. This wonderful mass setting was commissioned in partnership with our sisters and brothers of the Anglican Church in Perth and here in Brisbane, and also our Catholic sisters and brothers in Brisbane and Melbourne. And so we coordinated the commissioning process, but together we've asked Andrew to do this marvellous work, which has been designed to be used liturgically. And so it's a work that is full of modern interest and themes. It picks up one of my own interests, which is that of refugees and asylum seekers. It's built around the theme of the spiritual, I feel like a motherless child. And that really touches a chord as far as refugees and asylum seekers are concerned. They walk the face of the earth, nowhere to call home, feel like they don't belong anywhere. And one of the things we're trying to do through the Australian Church's Refugee Task Force that I chair is to reverse that feeling, to help Australia find its best self. We know that's a self that really does exist. Australians really do want to do the best thing and be people who do the right thing. And so the Church's Refugee Task Force works towards helping Australia recover that, take the issue very seriously. It's a very complex issue, but it's one that we can all find a solution to. And so, of course, Andrew's mass setting is being premiered here at St John's during the season of Advent, which is a time of waiting, expectancy and hope. And so that also works together with that theme of refugees and asylum seekers as we seek to be the gift of hope to them. And that fulfills the Advent theme as well.
I think that there's a reason that music has been such an important part of Christianity, other religions as well, but it's been a particularly important part of Christianity. I mean, many of the great works of Western music from the last 800 years have been religious in one way or another. So the two things seem to go together. And I suspect that for me, music occupies a place in my life and in my outlook that religion occupies for a lot of people. It, for a start, makes me quiet, which is a very good thing in this modern world. You can't listen to music if you're talking. And I'm sure that that's true for people who are believers, you know, in prayer, for instance, you know, you have to be quiet. So I think there's a connection there. I think it also brings people together because, you, of course, you can listen to music on your own, and much of the time one does, but going to a concert, you have a whole room full of people who are being quiet and concentrating on the same thing. So there's that too. And then, of course, perhaps most importantly, there is the fact that music is very mysterious. I mean, I say this as somebody who spends most of my time writing it, but I don't really understand how it works. I don't really understand what I'm doing much of the time as a composer. You find out by doing it. You sit down to write a piece of music and you have a plan, probably. And sometimes the plan works out and sometimes it doesn't. But really, when a piece is going very well, the music takes over and it tells you what to do. So there is something greater than me in the music. And I'm sure every composer has felt that. The excitement of when a piece of music is going well, when the piece seems to be writing itself.
Kyrie, the Lord have mercy, from Andrew Ford's Refugee Mass. And Andrew Ford was talking to Jeff Wood for The Rhythm Divine. You can listen back to the complete program by going to the RN homepage.
One of the biggest international stories of the last 12 to 18 months has been Christians, Jews, minority religious groups like the Yazidis, and many equally terrified Muslims fleeing Iraq and Syria in vast numbers. Syria is so complicated, it's hard for most people to understand the warring factions. And equally hard, it seems, for much of Western media to cover the tide of Christians and Jews leaving the very places that were once the cradle of Christianity and Judaism.
Well, last week, Andrew West sent back some powerful and worrying interviews. They came back for the Religion and Ethics Report from a Rome conference on persecution. It seems that church leaders are torn between two sort of contradictory things, hoping the church still has a future in the region, but then trying to keep their people safe. Which one do you choose? And mass has been said in places like Mosul in northern Iraq for nearly 2,000 years, but not since the city fell to ISIS last year. A lot of these people have ended up in Erbil, and that's a town in Kurdish-controlled northern Iraq. And in the next hour, Rachel, we will be the first in the world to hear a special Christmas message from the Archbishop of Erbil, the Catholic Archbishop, basically from the refugee camp.
Well, that's a real coup. It's been reported that the last Jews in Aleppo fled last month. A knock on the door one night and people concerned for their safety smuggled them out to Turkey. Terrifying and pretty sad. In fact, I met an amazing woman in Toronto just recently, Judy Feldkar, who over a 28-year period from the 70s to the early 2000s helped smuggle 3,228 Syrian Jews out of Syria secretly. Extraordinary. The fact that she did it secretly is even more amazing, leaving a population there of little more than 1,200. It's a fascinating kind of Schindler-esque story, which you'll be able to hear in detail on The Spirit of Things next February.
Do you think it's peculiar that with Syria in the news at the moment, dominating it, that Afghanistan has all but dropped off the radar? When I was presenting Sunday nights for ABC local radio earlier this year, I went up to Newcastle on the New South Wales Central Coast to meet up with some Afghans. These guys had been interpreters with our troops. They'd been, you know, in harm's way. And it turns out that one of our colleagues, Rachel, Stephen Watkins, who presents for The God Who Sings on Classic FM, he's actually become personally very involved with these Afghan families, and he's been helping to settle them in Adelaide. It's a really interesting story. And he's joining us now to explain that really special relationship he's noticed between Afghan boys and their mothers.
In an Afghan home, when there is entertainment, the men are in one area and the women are in the other. Women do not meet men until it is appropriate for the family to bring those two together. The children, the young boys, are usually with the women and the children until a certain age where they can mix between the two. So they may go into the woman's territory and they will bring the food to the men. They are the interchanging people at that stage. Then they move through to being adults where they sit with the men. Now, what happens in a family, an Afghan family, is that some of the young boys, when they get to a certain age and young women turn up because they've got sisters and the like, they might go out on the street together and get out of the house, go somewhere else. And so we're dealing with that culture in this country as well, where the boys might be all together on the streets, or they might go outside, or they'll go to their room or whatever. But the essential thing here is that young men are brought up with the women until a certain age, and they adore their mothers. Not only are they trained to adore their mothers because of the family context, but they also have a religious obligation upon them that the mother is sacred next to God.
Sacred next to God, you say?
Yes, worship at her feet. And the interesting thing about that is that when my mother was aging, and she died at 100, some of the young men would visit her more than the Aussies would visit her.
Wow.
They would come regularly to visit her, and she would say to them, even though she had dementia at the time, "You are my sons. You are my sons." So that one of the Afghans spoke at her funeral, and he said she always said that we were her sons. We always respected her as our mother.
Is the mother and the family part of the dynamic of young men in particular leaving? Are they urging them to leave? Is that what's happening?
They could be under threat of being cajoled into serving in a military force by either their peers or by family context, particularly during Afghanistan when we had the Mujahideen. One part of the family may not know what the other family were doing, so it was very, very difficult. And then when you had the Taliban coming in and upsetting the Mujahideen arrangements, then it became almost unviable for any family to keep the young man there, because surely the young man was going to be killed. The young man in the Afghan home takes the role of father in many cases. Mm-hmm. He takes the responsibility of the home, especially if the father has died or the father is not available to be able to run the family.
I recall speaking to Ahmad Shuja from Kabul, and he mentioned to me, he actually joked, he said the Americans sometimes ask him if there's a Walmart on every corner. And he says to them with black humour, oh no, no need, because every civilian is a target here.
That's right. And that's the circumstances now that he says wasn't like that 2 years ago, but it is like that now. It's becoming far more dangerous.
We're doing this in the context of a Christmas broadcast where we're giving great thought to the idea of the Holy Family being refugee and seeking refuge. And I understand that within Afghan culture there is great respect for older relatives too, that the family is very key, the extended family.
Sometimes they've got quite large families, so the extended family is very important. I brought a family to Australia, a young man who came to Australia, who was only 13 at the time of his death, on a road going to Melbourne on Christmas Eve, and that family were in touch with me later. They were in Pakistan, in Quetta. They'd moved there from Afghanistan, from Kabul, and the family begged me to be able to support them because they had no other access to Australia. They had no other support. And the mother, devastated by her son's death to the point where she lost her youngest child as well, another son. Then I was able to bring them finally to Australia, and the tears that were shed for weeks and weeks and weeks after arriving on our soil was extraordinary. Such is the importance of the eldest son.
How did you personally become involved? In a sense, I'm a broadcaster talking to a broadcaster here from the ABC, but this is not actually about your broadcast life strictly, but you did actually become interested in this matter through a program you made, didn't you?
Yes, I was making an encounter documentary for Radio National, and I was asked to do one on asylum seekers. This is the days when people were in Woomera Detention Centre, which was up in South Australia.
Which I've been inside, I must say.
Oh, you were doing better than I am. I haven't, and I wasn't at the time able to, but I was talking to people who were coming out of Woomera, and I remember sitting on the floor with an Afghan or an Iraqi, I'm not quite sure now, and as he unfolded his story and his pain, I had a very strong sense of the presence of God in that situation, which I, you know, these are mysterious things and we find it very difficult to account for these, but it was enough to propel me to do something. And so I finished the documentary, and later on I started teaching English to people, and it turned out to be four Afghans. Those four Afghans have done very well in business since. They have been able to make lives for themselves, and at that time there were very few resources on the ground for what was a surge of boats arriving in a country. So lawyers needed help, there were a lot of volunteer work needed to be done, and so I submitted to that and have stayed with them ever since.
Before we wind up, I want to talk to you about boys held in detention, because if any of our refugees do make a step which breaks the code of conduct, there is a combination not only of our normal law but immigration law, which will move quite harshly against them, it sounds.
I have a young fellow who was charged last April. It was actually on Good Friday evening. He found a girl, or the girl found him, on the website, and he went to have a relationship with her, and it didn't work out. And he was charged with a sexual offence. The case, I think he's been, in my view, quite consistent with his story. And in the end, the evidence seemed to come down on his side of the story and the case was dropped. However, the moment he was charged, because he has a bridging visa E, he had his visa cancelled because he had broken the code of conduct. And that meant he was detained. He was put into a detention centre. He is still in detention centre, even though the charges no longer exist. And we have no knowledge about when he will get out. He's been there for 9 months so far. And we're just waiting for the minister to intervene. And when that will happen, we're not quite sure.
It's Christmas Day, Stephen Watkins. What do you want to say in terms of Christmas wishes to the families you're involved with?
Many families have invited me out for Christmas this season, and I think that the Christmas is an important celebration for the Afghans as well. They come from a different religion, but they have a great respect for our tradition, and they have a great respect for the birth of Jesus and for his mother, Mary. Within the family that I have been associated with, there will be celebration. We will all share together. I am the uncle, and we have a great love for each other.
We have run out of time, Stephen Watkins, but I do want to ask you, how much of a sense of hope is there among these young men, and how much encouragement can you give?
It's not only the young men, it's the young women too, and the young men and young women are doing exceedingly well, particularly those who've had the chance of education. They're ending up in university, they're doing law, they're exceedingly fine citizens of Australia. And I know people, those who I first met here, are now running very successful businesses. They're entrepreneurial. They've been through hard times. They know what it's like to fight for your existence. And they have fought for their families. They have progressed in Australia, and they've become very, very fine citizens.
Stephen Watkins, in your normal day job, presenter for The God Who Sings on Classic FM, but very involved with refugees here in Australia, thank you for being part of Christmas Breakfast.
My pleasure.
Well, education is important, but I think a good dose of humor gets you through a lot of those tragic, challenging situations. John Clark and Brian Daw, alias Clark and Daw, add a touch of humor to ABC News every Thursday evening. And this sketch about our Pollies putting on a nativity play with John Clark playing leader of the House, Christopher Pine, is definitely worth a replay this morning.
Christopher Pine, thanks for your time.
How poetic, Brian. Lovely to see you.
You're the Leader of the House, of course.
I have that signal honour, Brian, yes.
What happens at the end of the parliamentary year?
Well, the parliamentary year comes to a close. The final sitting, Brian, is completed, and then all the people go back home to their electorates.
Mm, there must be a Christmas party, though.
Is there actually rather a good final function, Brian, with, you know, carol singers and so on.
Carol singers? Who's she?
No, not carol singers, Brian. Carol singers. People who sing
carol
carols.
Singers.
They do
Sorry.
It in the foyer. It's fantastic.
Oh, hark the herald angels sing, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Ding dong merrily on high.
Of course, yeah. Do you do a nativity play?
We haven't done the nativity play in the last couple of years, Brian, for various reasons. But yes, we are doing the nativity play this year.
Good. Why didn't you do it in the last couple of years?
Well, you need three wise men, Brian.
Oh, and I see, yeah.
Frankly, we struggled a little bit there.
Yeah, but you got it sorted out this year.
We've got three wise women this year, Brian. It's gone well.
Right. What did you do in years past?
For the three wise men?
Yeah.
Well, after Tony Windsor left the Parliament, Brian, we just had to have Nick Xenophon come in a sheet and say that his two mates were parking the donkey.
Right. No trouble casting the donkey, of
course. Oh, no. There's a ton of talent around here, Brian, if you know where to look.
Yeah. But thematically?
Well, thematically, there was always a little bit of a difficulty. A lot of people in the Parliament thought it was sending the wrong message.
Right, it really was that.
Well, do you know the story, Brian?
Of course.
These two people, one of whom is pregnant, the woman, they travel enormous distances, they get lost, they don't know where they are, and then eventually they arrive in a completely new place and there's nowhere for them to stay,
but
Brian.
But the locals so take them
the
in.
The locals have to take them in.
Yeah, because there's an accommodation crisis.
There is,
isn't there?
And they've got no choice but to take them in, Brian, because obviously everybody's doing this. And they put them in a shed. They say, you can sleep out here in the shed. We'll make a bed up or whatever's in the shed.
Sure.
And then the woman, Brian, has a baby in the shed.
Yeah, this is the nativity bit,
isn't it? This is the nativity bit, Brian.
Yeah.
Now, the question there is, does the baby come from where the shed is or where the parents came from or where the mother came from originally, Brian? Just ignore that.
Who is that?
That'll be Peter Dutton, Brian.
Peter Dutton, what does he want?
I've repeatedly told him, Brian, that Pontius Pilate is a completely different play.
Hmm. Will you be having a break over Christmas yourself?
I will, Brian, with my family, as indeed I hope you've done wonderfully well this year. I hope you have a lovely time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Pontius Pilate.
Pontius Pilate, yeah, he's bought the robe, Brian.
And Peter has?
And he's bought a basin. He's bought some sandals and some soap.
You're going to have to tell him.
He won't listen, Brian. He won't listen.
Oh, the inimitable Clark and Daw. Well, that sketch brings us to the end of the second hour of this RN Christmas Breakfast. Join Noel Debien and me, Rachel Kahn, after the news.